From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Before he co-created the FX comedy series Reservation Dogs, Sterling Harjo directed three micro-budget films in his home state of Oklahoma. He had tried knocking on Hollywood's door, but somehow he never could find financing.
I heard that multiple times, that Native films don't make money. You know, I even heard like, well, this film's just a little too Indian, you know, or like, this film's not Indian enough. We don't know where to kind of categorize it, you know? So it was very confusing.
Harjo tells us about almost leaving the industry entirely before teaming up with longtime friend Taika Waititi to create Reservation Dogs, a quirky coming-of-age comedy with an almost entirely indigenous cast and crew. Season one is streaming now on Hulu, and the network just announced plans for a season two. But first, is Time's Up for Time's Up? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Shang-Chi, which is a very important movie to the movie business generally and to Marvel also, had a huge weekend, Labor Day weekend, normally a dead zone. It had a $94 million opening. This was a bold move. I think Kevin Feige has done more representation on a mass level than I can't think of how many people who could say they did Black Panther and then they did Shang-Chi. He has taken Marvel where he wants it to go. He has the clout to do it. But there will be and is continuing discussion about what it means, because it was not a movie that Disney put on the streamer for a $30 upcharge as it did with Black Widow. It's not day and date like the Warner Media model where they put it on the same day it opens in theaters for no extra charge if you were a subscriber to HBO Max. So what does it mean? Does it mean that people were super antsy to get out of the house? Does it mean that people's love of Marvel trumps all else? Does it mean that not putting it on a streamer made it big and it proves that the other model kills movies in theaters? What does it mean?
Well, I think all of that can be true, and sort of none of it can be exclusively the reason for this. I mean, yes, Marvel is Marvel and people do show up for things that they care about. I think the Disney CEO, Bob Chapek, essentially dared Shang-Chi to do well at the box office. He called it an experiment explicitly, and he was not expecting this result. But here we are. And now the question is, for the rest of the fall season, what does it mean for all of these other movies that are on the tarmac and ready for liftoff? I think that the Bond movie people are very excited by this because they see No Time to Die as this kind of a movie that might get people to say, you know what, it's worth it to come out to the theaters. I think Marvel itself is looking at The Eternals, which is supposed to come out in November, and thinking this might be a reason to give it an exclusive theatrical release and not go day and date with the strategy that they did on Jungle Cruise and on Cruella and some of the others. And I think heading into the holiday season, I mean, nobody knows what COVID is going to do, but this is a big, big vote of confidence in these fall movies.
I will note, as we know, Kevin Feige, who runs Marvel, is not a guy who even wanted Black Widow to go with a $30 upcharge on Disney Plus. He has a lot of influence, I would say. He's probably the most valuable single person in Hollywood. I don't know, you can argue with me if you want to on that point. And so he may be a defender of theaters with more power to defend theaters than anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, this is the narrative that he wanted for this movie. The Black Widow narrative is not what he wanted, but it's interesting because the narrative that Bob Chapek wanted was that press release after Black Widow came out touting how well it did on Disney's premier access tier on Disney Plus, because that is what the stock market values. They value that, you know, the future and whether you're bringing subscribers into the universe of Disney Plus. So, you know, there is a tension here, but it's hard to deny the numbers that Shang-Chi did. And we'll see about how it holds in its second, third, fourth weekends. But if it continues on this trajectory, I think it really does show that for the right movie, you can still do a number in theaters, and it's worth it to give certain big movies a theatrical only window.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, as we touched on, I think before, with the Mission Impossible movies and Top Gun, the other powerful defender of movie theaters is probably Tom Cruise, who will not brook his movies going to a streaming service in any circumstance. So those were pushed again. And I don't know whether there's a regret now in the part of Paramount that maybe they could have gone a little earlier with those big movies, seeing these numbers. But between Kevin Feige and Tom Cruise, we're going to see people fight for theatrical release only who have the power to do it. Let me turn to another aspect of power, which has gone rather badly, which is the fate of Time's Up. We haven't talked about that yet. You know, Time's Up, the problems, I think, were there at the beginning. You had a disparate group of power women in Hollywood, some of them very famous, Reese Witherspoon, Shonda Rhimes, who that sort of person, Eva Longoria, very much wanting the right thing. I think we should give them all presumption that their intentions were excellent, but there were problems from the beginning. It was sort of hatched in the very building of CAA, which is a huge power center of Hollywood. There were a lot of people with competing agendas and different areas of interest. And when you have that kind of a group in the first place, you know, there were allegations that they were being exclusionary and certain women couldn't figure out how to join, how to be part of it in the industry. You also have a very difficult situation of somebody standing up and saying to that kind of player, this is how it is. This is how it's going to be. I'm running this shop. And things went really south. It most publicly became clear with this Andrew Cuomo scandal, which led to his resignation as governor of New York, because two key players, Tina Chen, the executive director, and Roberta Kaplan, a prominent attorney, women's rights attorney who was on the board, both got pulled into advising the Cuomo camp. And when that came out, ultimately, both of them had to resign. Very bad look and bad press. It is a sad situation because this was such an important group. And I want to distinguish it, Matt, of course, from the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which has done work for regular women and has raised money for that and has had some effect. But the taint on Time's Up itself, I don't know if you recover from that.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. And the board members, the prominent ones, have all exited the board quietly over a holiday weekend. They announced on a Saturday of a Labor Day weekend. This is a big embarrassment. It really, what it showed in the Cuomo example and also in some other examples throughout Hollywood is that when you have these powerful women who have good intentions and put together this group for a purpose, it is sometimes difficult to make that change within the power structures where these women have relationships and businesses and are trying to do the best that they can for themselves as well as the organization. We saw Time's Up getting involved in bizarre disputes like the fight over the Golden Globes and the HFPA's diversity issues, while other things, you know, the more glaring issues with the studios and some of their news divisions and all these other things that have been going on, Time's Up has been silent. And they've also used their power to kind of act as an almost like a rehab mechanism for certain people that have been accused of improper behavior, almost like, you know, if you work with us at Time's Up, we will help rehab your reputation. And that is not really what a lot of the victims of sexual abuse thought this organization was going to be doing. And you saw when the announcement was made over the Labor Day weekend that some of the victims of sexual assault were saying, good riddance, this group has not done enough for victims.
Yeah, I mean, so what we have is a situation where they raised a lot of money from Hollywood companies. They did raise some money, as I said, for the Legal Defense Fund, which is separately administered and runs on a separate track. There's controversies on that end, too, but there's always going to be. But I think they get much higher grades. And meanwhile, I don't know how much of that money really got spent advancing the cause of Time's Up in the main organization that started. And I don't know that that organization can continue to be a thing, which is a shame because I don't think anybody's under the illusion that this whole big battle is won. You know, I see a lot of guys thinking, you know, as Andrew Cuomo tried to do, thinking I can brazen this out. I can kind of just come back and pretend nothing ever happened. And we need a watchdog in Hollywood. And I'm not sure anyone has figured out a way to do it. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News and author of the newsletter, What I'm Hearing. In the FX comedy series Reservation Dogs, high school friends Bear and Alora dream of getting out of small-town Oklahoma and moving to California. In the first episode, now streaming on Hulu, the friends seize an opportunity to make some extra cash when a delivery driver steps away from his truck full of spicy potato chips.
Put your seatbelt on.
Seatbelt?
Oh, people safety.
We're stealing a
chip. I do not give a man. Put your seatbelt on.
Jesus Christ. Okay, weirdo.
Ultimately, Bear and Alora's plans for escape get pushed off to another day. They and their friends have plenty to deal with at home on the reservation, including a rival gang encroaching on their turf. Reservation Dogs features an almost entirely indigenous cast, as well as an all-native writing team. That makes it the first of its kind, and co-creator Sterling Harjo hopes it won't be the last. Harjo came up with the idea for Reservation Dogs with his longtime friend, Taika Waititi. When Waititi went off to make the next Thor movie, Harjo had to take on showrunning the series on his own with many questions about how to do that job. Harjo and Waititi first met through Bird Running Water, the longtime director of Indigenous programs at the Sundance Institute, where Harjo was selected for a fellowship in 2004.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bird basically was kind of almost curating and pulling different artists together and really growing this like Indigenous film community. And, you know, through the support of Sundance, I went out to the Sundance Labs and then I was at the festival. And Taika and I met because he had also been one of the people that Bird worked with over the years and also went to the labs. And Taika and I met, you know, at some of Bird's get-togethers and functions. And really that's how we became friends and just remained friends after that because of the Indigenous sort of film circuit.
You were making films and a doc all in Oklahoma where you wanted to work. That was a deliberate choice.
Yes. I mean, you know, I've always sort of been stubborn in that I didn't want to leave here. And, you know, I always looked up to filmmakers like Richard Linklater that stayed in their communities and helped those communities grow as well. And so I always wanted to do that here in Oklahoma. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, you know, along the way, I was told a lot of times that I wouldn't be able to do that. You know, I think that it's very rare that people try to do that. And so, you know, I was told numerous times that that was impossible, that I would have to move to LA. I just never did. And I just made my films here. And honestly, it was like, I went out to LA and I used to take meetings right after the Sundance Labs. I went out there with my script and I thought I was like the toast of the town. You know, I thought I was going to really, I thought they were going to, all the doors were going to be open.
Right.
But it was a very different time then. It was a very different industry then. Talk of diversity was not in the air. And different people that I would share the script with, everyone loved the script, but ultimately the writing was on the wall and they were not going to make the film. I remember one guy saying, you know, if we could get someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman on the poster, you know, maybe we could do, you know, fund
this. So, yeah, such a bad cliche, but go ahead.
Yeah. And it was very much like a different time period, you know? So I sort of tucked tail and ran and went back to Oklahoma and I was like, they're not going to make my films out there. So I had a bit of a career here in Oklahoma and I thought I could find the right support. And I did. I started making my films on a micro budget. He was barely making a living, honestly, but it was film to film. And I just knew that at some point the industry would change. And all I had to do was stick to my guns and keep making films. And I did that and it did change. And then I, you know, started coming back out to LA once streaming and TV was, I started getting jobs in that arena. And I could just feel the difference. You know, people were interested in stories and my stories and they were also impressed that I'd made so many films on such a low budget, you know, and just kept working throughout the years. And I think that really actually helped me a lot. I think that helped me a lot, kind of give people confidence in hiring me.
Right. They thought this guy gets it done for a price.
That's right.
Which is important. I mean, you were on that in the bad days of, well, I would say bad old days, except they were more like 10 minutes ago. You know, it was that loop of, well, we don't think this will make money because Native films, I mean, it's always like baseball films don't make money. Native films don't make money.
Oh, yeah. I heard that multiple times that Native films don't make money. You know, I even heard like, well, this film's just a little too Indian, you know, or like this film's not Indian enough. We don't know where to kind of categorize it, you know. So it was very confusing to just say, hey, I just want to tell a regular story about people, you know.
People that you know.
That's right. People that I know and people that are in my family and, you know, not necessarily films about identity. It was just stories, you know, like that's what I wanted to express. And it wasn't what they wanted. But, you know, and I could have let that discourage me and stop, but I just knew that I needed to keep telling these stories.
So practically speaking, how did you put together those micro budgets?
I mean, it was so random, you know, it was like so many different ways. I mean, one time my producer, he lived in Tulsa. He'd been rejected numerous times on trying to get funding for the film, calling everyone he knew. And he literally, out of frustration, yelled in his office. He worked in a law office. He yelled really loud, does anyone know anyone with any money? Except he used a curse word. And this intern sort of rolled back in his chair and said, I might. And literally introduced him to someone who was interested in funding the film. And that's how I got my first film funded.
I'm just thinking with a new approach, you're going to have people yelling out in offices all over the country, but go on.
Exactly. No, no. And then another time there was just a guy with money that had approached my producer because they had a film that sort of fell apart, but the money was still there. And they were like, does Sterling have anything that he wants to make? And I had I'd written half a script and I was about halfway through it. And so I told my producer to lie. And I said, tell him that I'm working on a second draft and I'll get it to them in 2 weeks. And so I finished this script called Barking Water in a couple of weeks, sent it to them. And then I was making it a few months later.
Wow.
Exactly. It's pretty crazy.
This has been, I mean, I know that you get, the show gets talked about so much because as the first, I imagine that's kind of gratifying that it's being talked about, but a little frustrating that you're still in that lens of the, you know, the first.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's a blessing to be able to do that, but it doesn't stop with this show. I think that there's so many stories out there and so many Indigenous stories that need to be told that I hope that it opens the doors for all those other stories to be told.
Yeah, I hope that somebody does, because it is crazy. I think I read somewhere where you said it felt that, you know, it's diversity with Native coming in last as far as priorities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're a small portion of the population. And it's interesting because we've been a part of cinema from the beginning, though, right? Like even Edison films back in the day were depicting Native people dancing and different things. And so it's interesting that it's taken this long to really kind of tell our own story. I mean, you know, we were always the zombies in the Westerns, you know, we were sort of faceless and soulless and we were in the way of Western expansion and we needed to be eradicated. So we served a function in a way in American storytelling. But that function never allowed us to tell our own story. And so it's interesting and gratifying as well that we're finally being able to tell those stories.
Yeah. Now, you didn't want this to be like this, you know, you wanted it to be a comedy. And right. Taika and you, I gather, you know, being friends, talked about it, and at some point decided working together was a thing to do.
Right. You know, Taika had an overall deal at FX and, you know, and we were friends and I watched him sort of explode into this superstar. You know, it's like, it's a strange thing to watch your friend do that. But I never asked for help or like, you know, hey, can we do something? I never did that because we were friends. And one day he said, hey, I have this overall deal at FX. Would you be interested in doing something? And I was like, yeah. And so that's really all I needed to hear. And throughout the years, we had read each other's scripts and gave each other feedback. And so, you know, we took two ideas of scripts that we both had written and we sort of just mesh them together. And it really came out of that in one night. We just came up with it. And, you know, and I wrote some stuff down. I sent it to Taika the next day. And I think that it's pretty interesting that, I don't know, like, you know, I thought I wouldn't hear from him again for like a year and we'd talk about it then. But like all of a sudden, my agents are like, you have an offer for a pilot. And it was like that fast. It was a few days later, you know, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, an executive at FX told me that he took it to FX and he said, you have 45 minutes to say yes or no, and then I'm going out with it. And they were like, yes, yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, to have that sort of swagger, you know, like, I don't know if I could do that, but, you know, Taika did it, so.
I mean, I sort of admire your reticence. It's such a thing that happens to people who do become that big that then people start tugging on their sleeve and asking for things. And you just were like, I'm just going to sit, wait and do my thing. And maybe, you know, at some point, maybe we'll work together.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, because I respected that space and friendship, obviously, like, you want to be surrounded by people you can trust, you know, and you also want to work with people you can trust. And so I think Taika appreciated that, you know, that I was always really just there for him if he needed to talk, as he was kind of exploding and talk through things and similar. He was similar for me, you know? So it's truly been a really good friendship. And what better way to sort of celebrate that friendship than have a show together?
Coming up, Sterling Harjo tells us why he almost retired from the industry before creating Reservation Dogs. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Sterling Harto, co-creator and showrunner of the FX comedy series Reservation Dogs. The show follows Indigenous teenager Bear and his friends as they deal with challenges big and small and dream of escaping a rundown town in Oklahoma. Harjo and his writers set out to put their own twist on the tropes that tend to show up in movies about natives that have generally been made by non-natives. When Bear and his buddies get mowed down by paintballs from a rival squad, Bear has a vision from Spirit Warrior, played by Dallas Goldtooth. The apparition claims to have fought bravely in the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Well, I didn't actually fight. I actually didn't even get into the fight itself. But I came over that hill real rugged, like, I saw Custer like that. That yellow hair, he was sitting there. Son of the morning star, that guy right there. I really hated him. So I went after him. But then the damn horse hit a gopher hole, rolled over and squashed me. I died there.
You know, like there's not a lot of Native actors in Hollywood beating down the door to play the next cliche or getting shot in front of a teepee sort of role, you know? So a lot of the Native actors and talent don't live in Hollywood, and you really have to do the work to go outside of Hollywood to find those. You have to go into the communities to find them. And Angelique Midthunder from Midthunder Casting, who casted the show, she was very down to do that. And we went to communities together and just met lots of kids all over. It was a really pretty beautiful experience. And also just reassuring, because there's so many talented actors out there, kids out there that can be in other shows or even this show later. I was impressed with how many great actors there were.
So Taika, having gotten you through the door, he then abandons you, goes off to make Thor. So you were just like, what? And then you had to, I think you called your friend Sierra Teller Ornelas.
Yeah, I called her, you know, because I mean, like, I always tell people, like, I mean, I found out what a showrunner was about a year before I became one. And the only other person I knew that was a showrunner was Sierra. She created Rutherford Falls. And I called her and I was like, hey, what am I doing? I remember asking her this. I was like, should I be like holding meetings or something? Like, is this up to me? Like, what am I supposed to do? And so, you know, she really talked me through it. And I was also a little worried because I was giving all of the directors are friends of mine. And I was a little worried because I'm a director first and foremost. And I didn't want to step on my friends' toes as directors, you know, and I needed to know what the relationship between the showrunner and director usually is, because I hadn't worked on a lot of TV. I directed one episode of the show, The Magicians. So I didn't really know that relationship and how it works. So I was really just talking it through Sierra, like taking me through how this works. And she was really helpful, really super helpful in helping me get through that initial sort of freak out.
Did you meet her just from around? I mean, where did you guys connect?
It's sort of the same thing. I mean, I think that the Indigenous film community gravitates towards each other. We always end up at the same festivals.
Right.
It is a community. And that's how I met her. You know, we were just kind of there for each other as we were trying to navigate this business. And I remember telling her I was going to retire at one point. I was going to start a nonprofit. And, you know, she was kind of like, that's ridiculous.
You were going to retire? You just were like, okay, this is too hard?
When you don't know the business, it's hard to know how it's going to go or how you can walk into the room and get a show, you know, or whatever you're trying to do. When you're out of it and people aren't coming to you for work or for your ideas, it can feel pretty lonely, I think. And especially, you know, I was outside, I was in Oklahoma. I wasn't in LA. So I was even one more step removed from the industry. I didn't know how to make that happen. And honestly, it happened because I started working with, you know, Allison Anders, a friend of mine. She
did Gas Food Lodging and maybe Vita Loca. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she and I had been mentors together for the Sundance Native Lab and really bonded over music. And her daughter, Tiffany, is actually my music supervisor on Reservation Dogs right now. But we became good friends. And she said, you know, if you ever need an introduction to agents and managers, like, I have a good team, let me know when you're coming out. And, you know, like, it took a couple of years for me to even make a move on that. I just didn't know how it worked. You know, I always felt like agents, if they want to be your agent, they'll come for you. And now I realize it's a business. Like, I could have easily just went to them and said, hey, I want representation. They would have said yes or no. We would have had a meeting. I realize that now. But at the time, I didn't know that. And, you know, and finally, I was going out to LA. I knew something needed to change. It was around the time I was thinking about quitting. And I reached out to Allison and I said, hey, can you give me a introduction to your team? And she did. It was literally the only team that I met with. I met them. They were all great. You know, but they became my team. And I owe that to Allison. And really, it was that. Like, they started putting me in the room with people. Also, there's a filmmaker named Chris Fisher who literally was the first person to ever help me in my career. He's the one that offered. It was right after Bird and I met. I sent him a script. And Chris Fisher had a film at the Sundance Film Festival, midnight screening. And he wrote Bird and he said, I want to support Native filmmakers. Do you have anyone you want to bring out? I want to give my flight and hotel room to a filmmaker. And Bird said, I know the right person, picked me to come out. And it just gave me the experience of working with, they put me with a couple writers. I worked with them. Years later, Chris Fisher gave me my first directing job on The Magicians.
Wow.
You know, there's people like that in my career that I feel like have been there and have helped me along the way, Tyke included. There's just a lot of people like that. And I try to do that myself. I try to pay that forward and, you know, give people work. And like I said, all my friends are directors on this show. And a couple of them are first-time TV directors. And being able to give them the opportunity, because that's all they needed was the opportunity. The talent was there. But being able to give them the opportunity was really a beautiful, fulfilling experience.
That is the power of a lot of things, networking and caring. And now let me circle back to the actual making of the show. You talked about, you know, as a new showrunner, how do I relate to these directors who are friends of mine and being, I guess, like, you know, how to be a boss. And I would imagine with the writers, I don't know how many of them were friends of yours, but I read that early on you went back twice to the writer's room and said, we're going to blow it up and redo. And I'm sure people must have just looked at you like, what?
Oh, man, they were very upset. You know, you wake up in the morning, like all the work that we did this week, we're taking it and we're throwing it out and we're starting over. And I would just have these like little panics at night where I would just be thinking about the show and be like, oh, this isn't the show. And so we'd come back and everyone was a little reluctant at first, but inevitably every time we would dig down and we would kind of go back to the source of what this show was and we would find it. And we always felt better. I mean, the worst days were the days that we didn't find it. We inevitably would find it the next day, but like, it was essential to blow those things up and to start from scratch.
Now, one of the things I read, you were talking about previous depictions and that kind of thing. You said, we're tired of seeing ourselves out there wandering through forests, talking to ghosts, and there's always flute music. And I get what you were saying. And yet, I will note that in the show, there is a wandering through forests, there are ghosts, or that's kind of right. So somehow you're just doing it your way, right?
I think it's turning the trope on its head and saying, you know, like, isn't it funny that this is what you thought we were like? And we were kind of at one point, but we're now going to let you in on the joke and we're going to all laugh at it together. I think it's a way to bring people into the show to get the humor.
I mean, there is also something of a tribute to the past.
That's right. There's definitely a tribute to the past in that because, you know, those tropes are pulled from reality. We are honoring the past. We're also talking about cinema of the past as well and the depictions of us. And, you know, if you talk to anyone, you say like, tell me the first thing you think of when you think Native American. Well, that's the image that they would come up with, unless they're watching Reservation Dogs now, and they might have new versions of what that would be. And I think that that's the beautiful thing about storytelling like this.
Sterling Harjo is the creator of the FX series Reservation Dogs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.